Okay, what we're going to do today is we're going to finish up the introduction and deal with Maharal's brother. The handouts will be up on the web. As I told you, they weren't ready for today. And then we get started on Maharal himself, so you don't have to have all that people, places, and dates anymore. So let's start with Rav Chaim ben Bezalel, Maharal's older, more famous, and more important in his lifetime brother. I already mentioned he wrote the Vikuach Mayim Chaim against the process of codification. And he also wrote a sefer called Sefer HaChaim, dealing with his worldview. And we're going to be dealing with several issues within it. The book is divided into topics. For example, the first section is called Zchuyot, our relationship with God. The next section is called Chayim Tovim, how to lead a good life. And then the third section is Slicha Umechila, what we now call Avodah. Meaning even these categories are very non-medieval. Zechuyot is about our relationship with God, and it's mainly Talmud Torah. Chayim Tovim is how we live our life. A lot about marriage and child rearing and obligations to the community. And Slicha and Mechila are things like Tefillah and Avodah. So notice this arrangement. Talmud Torah is already seen as the prime topic for Machshava. So unlike for the medievals, it was philosophy or Kabbalah. The importance of being part of the Kehillah and marriage and child rearing and staka, which when you get around to reading Bensasson's Chavrut v'Hanhagah, you'll see how they combined machshava and social planning. And then avodah is the third part, and that's where he has the least innovation. Yes?
Isn't there a section on
Geula and Yeshua? Well, yes, there is. And Geula and Yeshua is an Am Yisrael, the nation, larger people. And I was going to deal with that more further in the course when we do the Maharal on the nation. So the first part is Chuyot. Chapter 1. He says that the Torah has two parts. Muskalot. Those parts that deal with the intellect that affect the sechel. And mitzvot. The philosophers think that the first is more important, but he's going to say no, more important than the muskalot are the mitzvot. The mitzvot are all known as a tradition, ish mepi ish. They all have a deep sod to them. And all of Israel does the mitzvot, so therefore all of Israel gets Olam Haba. Olam Haba is not reserved just for the elite. So unlike the philosophers and the Kabbalists, who tend to make a hierarchy in which the elites get more Olam Haba, whether you are the Rambam or the Ramban, Sadia or the Zohar, the elite get more Olam Haba. He says all Yisrael gets Olam Haba for keeping the mitzvot, and the goal is to be Osek in Torah or mitzvot. And then not only that, the mitzvot are a greater oneg for your nefesh than philosophy is. Yes.
Why is the intellectual nature, why is the
Muskalot not based on tradition? For Chaim and Bezalel?
Yeah.
Is that for him? That's his axiomatic first chapter.
I'm saying the one of the key things about this was that they're based on tradition. Why is Talmud Torah not?
No, but to him, Talmud Torah is Alib de Hilchata. It's halacha.
Wow. And so what's Muskalot for him?
Philosophy and Kabbalah. I mean, that's our thing, that we think Talmud Torah is conceptual. For him, Talmud Torah was halacha. Chapter 2. And this is the one that gets quoted the most in Drashot, and it's actually printed in every Vilna Shas at the Hadron, pieces of Chapter 2, is Chapter 2 of Chaim ben Metzalah argues that Divrei Sofrim is greater than Deraita. Because Divrei Sofrim shows that we give of ourselves, while Deraita does not. And that's the whole point of the Hadron Halach, that we keep coming back and we're engaged in this process of Divrei Sofrim. He then also discusses several, in this chapter, several of the issues of the 16th century. One, he mentions that there are some Jews who make fun of the wild Agadot. Chaim ben Metzalah answers that these agadot are needed to preserve the halakha, the same way salt preserves food. These agadot preserve the halakha. They preserve the nistarot, and the true sod of the mitzvot, the true maaseh bereishis, maaseh merkava. So even if we don't understand the agadot, they are there in the Talmud to preserve what we do study. And he gives a story about someone who carves a worthless stick and carves it into a great figure. The stick is valuable because of the work you put into it. He says, so too the wild agadot. They're valuable because they point us in how to understand, I haven't given anything out yet. They point us in terms of how to understand the mitzvot. They point us to understand the true chokhmah. And he says, while some people do study these true agadot in the world of machshava and the world of maaseh merkava, maaseh bereishit, we are happy and it's sufficient for us to study halakha, because halakha is needed for this world. He says general philosophy is needed for those who want to study philosophy, but don't study Christian or general philosophy in the Beit Midrash. If you are going to study anything in the Beit Midrash besides halakha, let it be Maaseh Bereishis, Maaseh Merkava, through these agadot. Okay? No great answer here, but these are the issues of the age, and that's why I'm taking the time to do Maharal's brother, because the younger brother, the Maharal, is really going to be setting out to really articulate fully and in 19 volumes what the brother is saying in 3 pages. Okay? The importance of what the Talmud is, the value of the Agadot. It's all contained within the mitzvot. There is a deep meaning here. The meaning is not a separate discipline like the medievals thought. So this is not a course in Zohar, Ramban, Shari Orah, Ramak Ari. No, it's all the sod is going to be gained from the Talmud itself, and from Rashi and Midrash directly on Chumash. That's where the sod is going to be found. Now, the brother here gives us a nice analogy of carving a stick, but that's very different than what the younger brother is going to do, who's going to give us a full theory to explain everything. Okay? Yes?
They share the views of the similar?
They are similar in the sense that here we already see what the issues are of the age. And they're going to be the same issues. I'm dealing with the brother before we do with the Maharal. We will do with the Levush, the Ramah, and others after the Maharal, because they're going to go on other trajectories with the same problems. Chapter 3. Yes?
You see that the Maharal is influential in his life?
He was well known, but the brother was a great, if you use the phrase, Gadol Hador, Posek, one who represented jury, who went to the councils, the Moetzet, the synod, and was the main speaker. The Maharal was a very interesting figure and was involved in Yaradeya, Chevra Kadisha, Shchita, was a known figure in Darshan, but didn't have that same status his brother had. Chapter 3, the six orders of Mishnayot correspond to the non-Jewish wisdom of the philosophers. So therefore, if you study Mishnayot, you don't need philosophy. And here is what he thinks are the six fields of philosophy. And this is important, and that's why I'm doing this, to understand what the Maharal would have thought philosophy is. The six fields of philosophy. One, Zrayim corresponds to Emunat Hashem, and that corresponds to the work of the theologians. Moed corresponds to astrology, because Moed is all about based on the calculations of the calendar, and therefore astrology is so important in the 16th century, which it was. Nashim, which deals with marriage, death, and the cycle of life, teaches us the importance of reincarnation and the proper way to live in order to affect our souls. The Zikin corresponds to the importance of magic that's important out there. Remember, the Renaissance Italy, tie it back to the lesson. Renaissance Italy, magic was important. Astrology was important. The soul was important. Nobody here took my Italy course, but those are the issues that were important in Italy in the 15th century, and that's seen as what philosophy is.
I'm sorry, how's music and magic?
What?
How's music and magic?
Because magic is the way you control the world, and music and business matters is the way we control the world. No, it's not. That's the way magic actually, if you really think that the correct way to achieve wealth is through magical formulas, if you think that the way you're going to have success in your electronic store or your soccer team is to consult now with Rav Ifrigen, or now, you know, the recently passed away Rav Kaduri, if that's the way you do it, saying no, we have the Zikin. But that's important for understanding philosophy for him is not modern philosophy, not ancient philosophy, not medieval, but it was Renaissance occult philosophy. Kudshim, which is the correct ordering of the universe, because we know Karbonot maintain the universe, Ma'amadot, corresponds to astronomy. This is the great age of Kepler and Copernicus and others. Bear in mind that Copernicus lived in Poland, and Tycho Brahe is going to be in Poland. Astronomy will be a very Polish field. Taharot, which is about purity, means we don't have to study medieval philosophy like the Moreh Nevuchim, which taught us how to have a pure concept of God. Now, as much as that doesn't seem like philosophy to you, those were the Renaissance categories. And that's why, as I'm bringing out the Maharal, he's reading Yechiel of Pisa and Alamano and the Sfarno and all these Renaissance Jewish figures who were concerned with these matters. Chapter 4, Chaim ben Bezalel says that you have to support rabbis well. Because they're studying Torah for you? Because you can't do it yourself and Torah is important? And this is also an important thing to point out, where we think Torah is a universal that everyone can study Torah, their world it's still only Lomdim study. So they're not going to have the elitism of the medievals. You get Olam Haba through keeping mitzvot, but it's still the Lomdim who are studying Torah, that rabbinic class. Chapter 5, studying Torah gives those who study it the ability to do nisim and have special providence, special hashgacha. 6, we need to have zehirut and zerizut in all this. Chapter 7, this is a subtle one, and make a little note of this, because the Maharal is going to change the terminology. Chapter 7, he says, mitzvah tzricha kavana. That's very important, because there are deep sodot to mitzvot. Foreshadowing where the course is going, Maharal is going to say mitzvot ein srichot kavana meaning philosophy and kabbalah, but you do need to know the sod of it. Hence we can still paskin like those opinions that say mitzvot ein srichot kavana, but you need to know sod kavana, meaning what the medievals talk about, whether it's the Rambam or Jikatila. That's not, but you need to know sodot. The brother, on the other hand, is already setting it out, mitzvot tzricha kavana, and it's needing to know these agadot and the deep sodot they have. Any questions on this? Yes?
What's the difference between
sod and kavana? For Chaim b'Mitzalah, for Maharal, we're going to get to in great detail. Chaim b'Mitzalah, the older brother, says mitzvot tzricha kavana, and sees this activity of the agadot as a continuity of medieval medieval kavana. The brother Maharal is going to make a sharp distinction and say, no, it's not the same, and we're going to talk about that. Yeah. Book 2, Chaim Tovim, deals with the importance of the community, the importance of getting married, the importance of having children. And what's important here, and I'm just going to give you one example, in the chapter on marriage, he's going to say it's entirely a chesed of God, and all relationship that men have to women is a special chesed elyon given by God. Because men naturally would have nothing to do with women. If you trusted your senses, you would think that all women, including your spouse, is disgusting and entirely physical and corporeal. So you have a special chesed from God to be attracted to your spouse. He's going to say a lot of the same things about much of family life. Meaning on one hand it's incredibly important and it maintains the community, but it's seen as a special, God gave you a Yetzirah to be involved in these matters because there's no natural elements for these matters. That's going to be very important in the Maharal also. So unlike today, where we give drashot, that of course the naturalness of marriage, children, relationships, for them these are all special chesed elyon. And that'll head you off at the pass when we get to it in the Maharal. That you know, or when we even do, when he discusses Shabbat, or Tefillah, or Talmud Torah, where is the rest of the family? The answer is, there's a starting premise here that it's a man's society, and that men want to be with men, and that even though there's a community, those are special requirements and special chesedim to make it happen. and then we'll get to some incredibly extreme statements in the Maharal. Finally, Slicha u'mechila. He discusses how tefillah, the importance of Chazal, and understanding all the agadata of Masechet Brachot. And you've got to really understand when you say the Shema and Amidah, what Chazal intended. He's going to give you a few examples, but it's going to be left to the younger brother now to tell you fully what all agadata and shas means, what every agadata corresponding to every mitzvah means. And in there he reiterates that tefillah keeps you away from kishuf, because if you believe that you're in God's hands, you're not going to turn to magic. Okay. That is the introductions on the brother, and with that we can now turn to Maharal himself. Okay, from this point on we can talk about Maharal's own thoughts. We're going to give, for the rest of this class, I'm going to give you a few basic principles, and then we're going to keep building on them from there. So let's start with a general overview of what the Maharal is doing. First of all, for the Rambam, Maimonides, the goal of Judaism was to actualize your seichel, to actualize your intellect, in order to achieve conjunction with the agent intellect, the seichel apoel. And then it's yediat Hashem, it's your knowledge of God and the shleimut, the perfection that's achieved, that will get you into Olam Haba. That's the Rambam. For a Kabbalist, the goal is yediat Hashem through Kabbalah. And whether the goal then, after you have yediat Hashem, whether the goal is then to have kavanot, let's say kavanot tefillah and kavanot hamitzvah through your study of Kabbalah, or the goal is to bring down shefa, or to have dveikut, all of those are seen as forms of shleimut. But what we're going to have from the 15th century in Eastern Europe all the way now into the beginning of the 21st century is a moving away from those medieval categories and into categories in which Talmud Torah takes precedent over philosophy or Kabbalah. Okay, that's a general klal. You know, when you look at the Nefesh HaChayim, Talmud Torah is clearly taking precedent over philosophy or Kabbalah, so too now in centrist orthodoxy, Talmud Torah takes precedent over the medieval positions. Yes, you had a question.
Yes, you were saying the Rambam gets the only problem.
The study of philosophy. Whatever that means, whatever is included in that philosophy, but you're not getting it through Talmud Torah, and he says so explicitly. Yes.
Is Talmud Torah seen as distinct from philosophy and Kabbalah, or it's seen as the what philosophy and Kabbalah really is Talmud Torah?
For them, it was a rejection.
Okay.
Now, within currently at YU in centrism, we will reread texts of philosophers and Kabbalists, and wherever they say philosophy and Kabbalah, plug in Talmud Torah, so all Rishonim now point to Talmud Torah rather than to whatever they originally pointed to. You know, we have a certain way of reading now in which we read it without the original emphasis. Yes?
Where's that Rambam there?
351 of the guide to start with. But he clearly talks about who's inside and outside. But there's lots of minor places that he's going to, you know, also talk in those terms. I mean, for beyond that, you can have Yisodei HaTorah, Prakim Bet, Gimel, and Dalet, culminating in Dalet, Yud Gimel, where the Rambam talks about Masa Bereshit, Masa Merkava being higher than a Bayer Rava.
Rambam?
Yeah. What? It's a Gemara, right. Yeah. That's correct. Okay. It's somewhat paradoxical that our emphasis on Talmud Torah reads causes us to ignore the Gemara. They, on the other hand, did not. They are going to be in some way hyper-literal to the Gemara and actually say Maaser Merkava is someplace embedded within this text itself. So where for the medievals, the Shonim, the Maaser Bereishis, Maaser Merkavas in philosophy and Kabbalah, our 16th century is going to find it in the words of the Bavli itself. Okay, so let's now go on to the 15th century as a little background for still getting to the Maharal. Already from the 1390s, Rav Chastai Crescas, chief rabbi in Spain, rejected the medieval worldview. We don't have a sechel apoel. We don't have an intellect that our goal is not for our intellect to connect to the higher intellect. In fact, what we do have is the need to do mitzvot. So Crescas presents that in his Or Hashem. You find similar positions in Albo, and then later in the Chassid Yavetz. Similar trends were going on in Christian society of rejecting the medieval metaphysical structure and now toward a greater emphasis on human volition. That whole trend is called nominalism, in which we go back to the direct experience in the human volition, and we take all the medieval terms and say they were only names. They were nominal. They don't really have status. If you are a real Makubo, you believe in those structures. They're real. If you're a philosopher, you believe in those structures. But the nominalism of the philosophers, whether it's Crescas, Albo, the Chassid Yavetz, already brought the medieval philosophy into question. So when Chaim ben Bezalel and Rav Yehuda ben Bezalel, the Maharal, they are already now thinking in new terms. I mean, they're the generation that is now going to say, okay, if we're not, they're not having to fight the past anymore, they are now creating a new perspective.
If they were nominalists.
Well, they're already past that point. No, they also, which will come up when you read Ben Sasson, this is also the great era of everyone from the Hussites to Wycliffe to Luther, who also rejected the medieval worldview, and let's get back to the text. Chaim ben Sasson, in his book Hagud v'Hanhagah, will refer to another one of his articles called the Protestant Reformation Within Jewish Eyes. Jews were aware of these currents. Jews supported these currents. As we see, Rabbi Victor Kara had connections to the Hussite Rebellion and the Unitarians. There is going to be that element in which the metaphysical structure of the medievals will be peeled away before this new era. Okay, now the Maharal himself. The first thing the Maharal is famous for, like I said, he wasn't the Gadol Hador, but was for education. Maharal is the first one to give a theory of education for the common people. Because if we turn to Maimonides, he says openly, we teach the Hamon Am, the masses, through habituation and rote. Very few go on to understanding. The Maharal is now giving a theory of education that can apply to everyone. One, everyone needs to know Tanakh. Two, everyone needs to know Hebrew grammar. and know that their father sent their brother to study with Sfardim. We don't know if he sent the younger brother also, but, you know, there was clearly a household in which Dikduk mattered, which for Ashkenazim is a big thing. 3, you need to know Bikiyot in Mishnayot. Before you go on to Gemara, you know Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, you know the categories of Torah Shebaal Peh, a back-to-the-text approach. Next, you should study, when you do get to Gemara, you study it directly without Rashi and Tosfot. The goal was to master the text, not Tosfot on a Masechet.
And Rashi was a problem because...
You use it as an aid to understand the text, but it doesn't become writing super commentaries and why did Rashi say this and not that, answering up Rashi for Tosfos. Well, meaning, what did the Dibur Maskil of Rashi mean? Don't become the Marsha. Don't become any of those approaches. Don't go into the realm of Chiluk. What counts first is mastery of the text, not mastery of defending Rashi or the Yukim in Rashi. Next, Maharal was against not just Chiluk, he was against Pilpul, and he was against codification. Halacha should be known through direct mastery of the Gemara, and learning how to do Shakla Vitaria as part of the Gemara. And he's against Pilpul. Pilpul is the activity of asking outside questions that are not on the text. In the technical sense, 15th century Pilpul there was different schools of it, Regensburg, Nuremberg, in which you ask questions like, why did Gemara ask this Braita and not that Braita? It must have been to teach you something. Or why did Gemara quote only the first part of the Braita and not the second part of the Braita? That's an outside question that was not part of the intrinsic Shakla Vitaria of what you're doing of Pilpul. Hold on a second. Pilpul by the 17th century became questions of all sort of, well, of course they knew this, why did they do this and not that? And that's a lot of the world we see in the Sma or the Nodi Behuda or of Jonas and Eichitz. The fact that they're not used much in YU is because they think in very different ways. They were thinking in terms of asking questions about what about this, what about that? And then later you have the Pilpul of the Beit Yosef, and in Talmudus you would ask a conceptual question, how do I now make a category out of something? Once again, it's Maharal wanted everything to be flowing from the direct Shakla Vitaria. However, before I take questions, know that he himself practiced Chiluk. So they published, you can buy in the Svarim sale, the Chidushe Torah of Maharal on various Masechtos. They are straight Chiluk, like Marshal. And he was involved with commenting on Machaber Ramah also, because once people were reading it, he got involved also. He wasn't the purist like his brother. His brother remained one of those last bastions of keeping it in the traditional oral Shakla Vitaria way. He, on the other hand, we find him having counter examples. Yes?
First of all, isn't he saying that only for the master that's better? I mean, once you master all the other things, so then you can go on to higher.
That's correct. Only then, but he remained against Pilpul always. You can go on to Chiluk, you can go on to Tosfot, you can go on to Chiluk, you cannot go on to Pilpul.
And what's the difference between Pilpul and Chiluk?
Okay, the difference is Chiluk is asking a question on the text, a question of why is there a two answers in Tosfot? How would Rashi defend against Tosfos? There are things of the play. Chiluk is that play of treating Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos as one single primary text that you're commenting on. Pilpul is already starting with asking an outside question, why did it quote this and not that? Or having entirely outside questions that you want to create a bigger rubric.
Chiluk is once this is quoted, how do you put it all
together? Right. That's right. So the best way is if you have a Magid Shir who does a lot of Marshal, that's Chiluk. If you have somebody, I don't know if anyone here does currently in YU does Sma or Nadav Yehuda, but if you have somebody who then is, oh, take a great, if you have someone, take a Lumdus example, someone who now wants to create Hilchos Sharos from Kolata or Akula, that's a form of Pilpul. Is it with your hand there? Yeah.
So with Maharal, who proposes that type of questioning,
because it's hard. Once it's there, you can then study it once you've mastered the basic text.
Is that part of the study of the text? I mean, like not looking at one text in isolation and looking at the whole corpus of
who?
Of Maharal himself.
He would think that the Talmud Chacham should know the entire printed text.
Would he himself ask
the
types of questions that Tosfos would ask?
No, because that's already seen as the Ashkenaz tradition, and then you're studying it as a second order activity. Okay. He says, okay, now some of the things he's also new for. He's the first one to say we have to educate everyone according to their own level, and that every student learns differently. He obviously picks up in Pirkei Avot. What? Shlomo HaMelech said it and Pirkei Avot said it, but he's going to develop it. The medievals are going to think level means hierarchical level, rather than he's going to say there are different models out there. Well, the medievals are not going to make much out of, you know, we have four types of students, and he's going to start developing those. He's going to say we have to explain things in concrete terms. He's also going to speak about Torah as being a process, not just a goal. So we now have the importance of Chavruta and Shakla Vitaria and Machloket all being virtues unto themselves. For the medievals, all of those things were, okay, so why do we have Machloket if we know we have a pristine Torah? Maharal is the other way around. Torah can only be known through Machloket, through Chavruta, through Shakla Vitaria. Torah is about process. Maharal's students are going to start speaking about education. And in this, he's going to be parallel many of the theories of education in the 15th, 16th century, like by Comenius, who's going to be the first one to say that in the Christian Western world, that you have to teach kids according to their style of who they are, and you need to make picture books, and you need to make children's books. Nobody said that in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, children were to be educated as little adults from adult books. Yes.
Is this just what we know from his Talmudim, or did he write this up, or?
No, he wrote this up, and when you read Kleinberger, he'll collect all that material for you. Okay.
It seems Talmud Torah is a process. Is that like existential activity of Talmud Torah, or is it like something like further thought?
it's going to be metaphysical. And now we can get started with his philosophy. Okay, for the next half hour. And this you're going to hold on tight, because this is going to go through the end of next class as one long discussion of introduction to his philosophy. What is the philosophy of the 16th century? Let me take this in a broad sense. Let's think of the word depression. Do you have any psych majors here? What? Okay. Think of the word depression. In the 13th century, depression was an illness. You can look in Avicenna or in the Rambam and you see melancholia is a sickness. In the 20th and 21st century, once again, it's a sickness, it's a DSM classification. In the 16th century, depression is a description, it's an adjective. You can say a melancholy sunset. That's part of the richness of Shakespeare, that you can say a melancholy sunset. You couldn't do that in the 13th century, and the reason we can do it in the 20th century is because we were all, our high schools made us read Shakespeare. But you couldn't say it was a Asperger syndrome sunset. That doesn't sound right. The fact that we can say it's a melancholy sunset is because of the 16th century. You can't say it was a bipolar manic depression disorder sunset, but you can say it is a melancholy one. Let's take another one, matter. For medieval, you had matter and form based on Aristotle, Homer and Sura. Okay? And that's a scientific word, a scientific term, Homer and Sura. In the 20th century, you could talk about the periodic table, protons, electrons, molecules, but you couldn't say, you wouldn't use it as a metaphor for what's the molecular makeup of the classroom. Okay? It's weird. The 16th century used medieval scientific terms as adjectives and description. So from the 16th century, using a Shakespearean example, we have a phrase that occurs in almost every Shakespearean play, no matter which one you did in high school, what's the matter? You can now go to somebody and say, what's the matter? You couldn't do that in the 13th century. Saying what's the matter in the 13th century was like saying what's the proton? What's the molecule? To convert scientific terms into adjectives or descriptions was 16th century, what's the matter, meaning what's the most important, what's bothering you. And that shift in language is going to be important for the Maharal. That any medieval term from the Rambam or Sadia or anybody else can now be used as an adjective rather than its original context. And that's what confuses people, because it can't be pegged down anymore into its original form. Okay? You know, sometimes we do this in the 21st century. I mean, there are scientific terms that we have applied. We'll think about spiritual genetics. We'll speak about, you know, and then we were brainstorming all night and then we had a big bang of an idea. Some of them that have been more catchy, that have come more from astrophysics or from Nobel Prize winners have caught on. You know, I got sucked into a black hole last night and I got no work done. Have made their way into our language. But 16th century did it to everything. And now what I'm going to give you is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 category terms, which will take us through next class, that are basic premises for understanding Maharal's language that you need to know before I even open up the first page of Maharal. So maybe by the next class we get up to the Maharal, but you need these 12 categories of terms to understand it. First one, Homer and Surah. For the medievals, Homer is matter, and Surah is the form that you put it in. Meaning the chair is pressed plywood, the form is a chair. The table is sheet metal, the form is the desk. It has very precise meanings. For Maharal, Homer and Surah become floating categories in which anything that is higher than anything else and that affects anything else is Surah, and anything that is affected or is lower in a binary pair is Chomer. So to give you theme and variations, man is Tzura, woman is Chomer. Parents are Tzura, children are Chomer. Am Yisrael is Tzura, the Amim are Chomer. Talmidei Chachamim or rabbis are Tzura, congregants are Chomer. What? That's right. It's a continuous binary pair. It doesn't line up, but there'll be always, Maharal will come in, create a binary pair. The higher of the binary pair becomes Tzura, the lower of the binary pair becomes Chomer. Term number two. Chush and Sechel and Chush HaMeshutaf. Chush, Sechel, Chush HaMeshutaf, and finally Nivdal. For medievals, Chush is your senses. And for Aristotle and the Rambam, your physical senses are lower than sight and hearing, and sight and hearing are lower than mind. The Seichel for medieval is your rational functioning. For medieval, your seichel is your rational functioning. Your chush hameshutaf for medieval was a special faculty you had that brought together your senses, memory, and your intellect. It was a form of a projected CPU in your mind that brought together the various elements in your mind. Now let's talk about Maharal. What? They don't have that category. For Maharal, you're going to have to be somewhat hold off on questions until you get all the terms here. Is Maharal starts with a phrase from Baba Basra, Daf Yud Bet, Chacham Adif Minaveh. Okay? Chacham Adif Minaveh. And explains it in the following way, and this becomes one of the pillars of his thought, that since data are chush, while Torah is Sichle, Chacham Adif Minaveh is because Nevi'im use their senses, they receive visions of God, they use their senses, so it's transitory, it's Gashmi, it's only in their senses, while Chachamim, Talmidei Chachamim, use their intellects, which is not bound to the physical, which is not bound to chush, which is not bound to the transitory. Hence, Chacham Adif Minaveh. For Maharal, a Chacham does things internally, while a Navi does things externally. Maharal says the same thing about philosophers. Philosophers, since they need sense data, are externally oriented, while a Talmud Chacham, since he's entirely internal, is higher.
He's not using cases just like the block. He's not using cases of real life.
No.
Can you talk to me first or not? There's no short.
Well, that's going to be the interesting thing of where the Maharal is, how he reads Gemara. Okay? Hold on, so you have to be patient. Maharal calls this internal understanding Nivdal. So rather than for the medieval, I have a chush mishutaf that brings everything together, for Maharal, I have a nivdal, a separate realm of the seichel that is no longer connected to the senses. Now you will see that this same idea is not just in Maharal. It was said by many of the philosophers in Florence, the Renaissance Neoplatonists, who rejected medieval Aristotelianism and medieval Averroism, the most important which was Marcellus Ficino, who said that we're no longer bound to the world of medieval philosophy, which is the realm of the senses. Instead, we only live in a separate, disembodied, spiritual realm of the seichel. Or to give you what Ficino is famous for, the idea of Platonic love. Unlike carnal love, which is based on the senses, Platonic love is entirely internal without being concerned with the physical. Maharal is reflecting that same trend that's going on in a broad way, as are many of the Italian Jewish thinkers who we will bring up as parallels when we are actually doing Maharal. So those who truly like this and don't want the Maharal's whole system, that's, like I said, you'll be left saying, I like the Sephardo by the end, who will have the same emphasis on these without the grand system. Another example to give you to think about is Galileo. Don't think of these as influences, meaning Maharal's not reading Galileo, but to think about the broad world of the 16th century, where Aristotelian and medieval science was concerned about sense data. How does the moon look? Galileo taught everyone to say, don't be concerned with the naked eye. You've got to project rationally what it would actually look like and what it would be based on calculations, based on mathematics, that I'm going to use my observation in order to figure things out sichli, and it's not just from a common sense perspective. So where Aristotle's biology, physics, and astronomy were entirely sense data-based, we now have the shift first here in astronomy, which already came first, and then later it moved on, later centuries, to other sciences, of being concerned no longer with sense data, but in a rational universe. To give you an easy case, since most of you did not study astronomy in high school, it's not part of our curriculums, but I think most of you did study physics still in high school, I hope. The idea of friction. Okay? Back to Newton's laws. In Aristotle's laws, all things by nature will come to rest, because empirically that's what we see to be true. There's friction in the world, everything will come to rest. Hence it needs God as an unmoved mover to keep the world going. Newton comes along and says, no, in an ideal universe that had no friction, things will continue in whatever motion they were always going in. How do I know this? Because I figured it out using reason, not that I've ever created a perpetual motion machine. Meaning as I decrease friction, I oil my create ball bearings, I oil the trackway, whatever I'm doing, I get longer and longer periods of time before entropy sets in, and therefore I can theoretically postulate continuous motion. That's thought over sense data. Maharal is saying Torah works the same way. Like I said, that's an analogy from a later century, only because you've studied physics and rather than an astronomy case. But we're in a world now that's rejecting Aristotelian sense data in favor of a separate perspective, and Maharal claims that Torah also doesn't work sense data. Torah is the separate realm of Nevdal. Now I'll take questions. Yes?
Maharal would call it Rambam next.
Yes.
Sounds funny.
Because that's the whole point, is for Rambam, for Maimonides, things were based on their telos, their purpose, they had a function, and from that you thought about them. Maharal is now creating a explanation of the world that is firmly grounded in the rational realm without any need for sense data or teleology or function or purpose or connection to this world. That's why you've got to understand this terminology before we even open up one page of the Maharal. Third element, number symbolism. Number symbolism goes back to antiquity. The Ibn Ezra has number symbolism. If you look in Shmout, what is it, Chaf Gimel, the Rambam gives, the Ibn Ezra in his long parish gives you an equation. It says this equation is God. There's a nice book in the library for those from many math majors in the class called What Number is God? Those who thought in these terms actually did write equations on the board figuring out what number and what equation is God. We've lost the appreciation for it.
42?
What?
42?
No, they would go into long, long equations. Maimonides thought number symbolism, did not like number symbolism, even though he has it at one place in the guide. Crestus didn't like number symbolism. Number symbolism comes back in the Renaissance.
Is this the same thing between Zohar and...
No, because that's a four. Four is very different than saying I now have.
And
then Sefer Yetzirah is not believed. Whatever Sefer Yetzirah is, that's the answer is yes. It's probably the same as Sefer Yetzirah. Yes, but whatever it is, it's not. It's now this realm of speculative numbers, and it was in the Renaissance. Hence, the Christians translated Sefer Yetzirah into Latin in the Renaissance. And Maharal's number system is the following. Numbers are qualities. They are not quantitative, but they are qualitative. So the number one expresses true unity. Two expresses separation and division. Three reflects plurality. Four reflects completion. So unlike in Kabbalah where four is just the secret Shem Chavaya and the secret of the universe, here we're going to go through a whole theory about how do you permutate one number into another. Six is the number of space. Does not play a big role in Maharal. Seven is time. Eight is Lamala Minateva. Ten is complete multiplicity. If I want to say I have a full, what's the example I gave about? Since I can't say there's a compound in this classroom, or a full periodic table, my classroom, Basara, Asara Talmidim, was this class made up of? Or this class had a Sara Mamarot. There's a completion, a fullness to the number 10. What? That's right. Now you got it. And that's he says in, for example, Derech Chaim 5.5. He explains that fully. We will be dealing with this inside, but unless you can start thinking in these terms, you can't even open that one paragraph.
Did he make these up?
Or? No. These were known by others in the Renaissance, and a lot of these go back to antiquity. So, if you want to start with number symbolism, I suggest you go take out Iamblichus, and Iamblichus's commentaries on Porphyrius, and books on the Pythagorean. There's a book called The Pythagorean Reader in the library, and you'll get some sense of what went on in antiquity. For the Ibn Ezra, there are books on the math and the numbers of the Ibn Ezra. There's a book by Butler called Number Symbolism, another one called by Anna Maria Schimmel on the symbolism of numbers in Islam. There's a book by Hooper on number symbolism. Then when you want specifically the Renaissance, the proximate sense, I can give you more. But the answer is no. There's a clear, our age doesn't think in these terms. Okay. Since the invention of analytic geometry, and that numbers are arranged on a number line, and that they taught you in first grade to think 1, 2, 3, 4, we have a hard time thinking that they're discontinuous symbols once they were placed in a line. And if they taught it to you right in the beginning of your elementary school to think in a number line, they did that because that was useful for modern mathematics. In other ages, that's not the way math was taught. So even arithmetic and algebra had deeper resonances. So when Ibn Ezra gives you a long algebraic formula and says this algebraic formula is God, it has a certain meaning, because for him, he would assume that when you read his Sefer Tzachot or any of his books on numbers, he's already telling you the symbolism of each number. And that's how he would have taught it to kids. So therefore, by the time a kid gets up to algebra, you can ask, okay, so if nature stands for this formula and this, what's the formula for God? It's so doesn't resonate in the 20th century, but so many centuries thought in these terms. Yes?
Does this lead you towards geometry, or is this like something different?
This is different.
Does he do gematrias?
No. He does not do gematria. Gematria is a medieval form of number symbolism. If you want to know on gematria, there's a great book by Rav Tzuriel, formerly of Shalavim. It's called Or Torah. There's a copy in the library. It's not readily available. That explains the history of all the medieval gematria systems. Also, the chapter in Pardes Rimonim on Shar Hashemot is a nice chapter on number systems. We may have to. 12. 12 is 4 times 3, which stands for, if I multiply completion by plurality, I get complete plurality. Thank you. Because multiplicity means this is now the spectrum, like from the world is 10 mamarot. 12, on the other hand, is saying many. 12 is the same as 15, 17, 23, 98. It's all many. Well, not exactly. Because I need a Sarah Shvatim to show you that Am Yisrael is going to be a complete plurality. But I need Asara Mamara Divru Ha'olam to show you that everything is contained in here. Meaning 10 is a complete periodic table, a complete structure, while 12 opens up. 12 is going to be multiplied out. 12, you know, the next line will be 40 or 70 or 100, but 10 will always remain 10.
Well, now why isn't 12 separation of space?
Why?
Why is it the separation of space?
It is. It's the same thing. Therefore, and that's why the Machane was 12. It had both of those qualities. See, you're going to derive these Torahs on your own. That's the whole episode of the Machane.
Okay.
And then the Golem. You're, I mean, That's why I'm taking the time to give you this, because rather than say, okay, throw you directly in, once I can explain all of these things outside, then we're gonna start off with Shabbat and Pesach. And it's gonna make, oh yeah, that's why he's doing that. There's a hand up in the back somewhere that's going up or down. Okay. 40 is gonna be 4 times 10, which is
complete.
That's correct. And that's why it's going to be 40 days of the Vlad, 40 days on Har Sinai. Anything that's God's hand of 10 that I want to show its multiplicity within this world, like the creation of an embryo or the creation of Torah, is going to be a 40. By definition. Okay, I'm glad that everyone is still with me. I want to give some handouts. Here's an article. You don't have to read this for next class, but certainly we get around to reading this. We have a lot more to present before this makes sense to you. But by next Wednesday, meaning a week from this Wednesday, to read this and to start reading this for next, not this week, but for next week.
Where is this
from? That has yet to be published. Just got around to finishing it.
Yes?
Yeah. That's what I mean. No. Once there's two articles here. One article is, okay. One article is that I wrote, and it's the start of a series. The other one is a background, so you know where Andre Nahar is coming from. And with this, we're going to continue next class.